Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein continued. Cassette 9, Side 1. She posed and talked with Mike in her mind.
Feel anything?
I grok, but not in fullness.
Look where I am looking, my brother. The small one. He quivers. He thirsts for me.
I grok his thirst.
Can you see him?
Jill stared into the customer's eyes, both to increase his interest and to let Mike use her eyes. As her grokking of Martian thought had increased, and as they had grown steadily closer, they had begun to use this common Martian convenience. Jill had little control as yet. Mike could see through her eyes simply by calling to her. She could see through his, only if he gave it his attention.
We grok him together, Mike agreed. Great thirst for little brother.
Yes, beautiful agony. A music cue told Jill to resume her slow strut. She did so, moving with proud sensuousness and feeling lust boil up in response to emotions both from Mike and the stranger. The routine caused her to walk toward the rutty little stranger. She continued to lock eyes with him. Something happened, which was totally unexpected to her because Mike had never explained that it was possible. She had been letting herself receive the stranger's emotions, teasing him with eyes and body, and relaying what she felt to Mike. When suddenly, she was seeing herself through strange eyes and feeling all the primitive need with which that stranger saw her. She stumbled and would have fallen had not Mike caught her, lifted her, steadied her until she could walk unassisted, second sight gone. The parade of beauties continued through the exit. Offstage, the girl behind her said, "What happened, Jill?"
"Caught my heel."
"That was the wildest recover I ever saw. You looked like a puppet on strings."
"And so I was, dear.
I'm going to ask the stage manager to check that spot. I think there's a loose board." For the rest of the show, Mike gave her glimpses of how she looked to various men, while making sure that she was not again taken by surprise. Jill was startled at how varied were the images. One noticed her legs. Another was fascinated by the undulations of her torso. A third saw only her proud bosom. Then Mike let her look at other girls in the tableau. She was relieved to find that Mike saw them as she did, but sharper. But she was amazed to find that her excitement increased as she looked through his eyes at other girls. Mike left during the finale ahead of the crowd. She did not expect to see him again that night, since he had asked for time off only to see her show. But when she returned to their hotel, she felt him before she reached the room. The door opened, closed behind her. "Hello, darling," she called out. "How nice you came home." He smiled gently. "I now grok naughty pictures." Her clothes vanished. "Make naughty pictures."
"Huh?"
"Yes, dear, of course." She ran through poses as she had earlier. With each one, Mike let her use his eyes to see herself. She looked and felt his emotions, and felt her own swell and mutually amplified re-echoing. At last, she placed herself in a pose as randy as her imagination could devise. "Naughty pictures are a great goodness," Mike said gravely.
"Yes, and now I grok them too.
What are you waiting for?" They quit their jobs and saw every review on the strip. Jill found that she grokked naughty pictures only through a man's eyes. If Mike watched, she shared his mood from sensuous pleasure to full rut. But if Mike's attention wandered, the model, dancer, or peeler was just another woman. She decided that this was fortunate. To have discovered in herself lesbian tendencies would have been too much. But it was fun. Great goodness to see girls through his eyes, and ecstatic goodness to know that, at last, he looked at her the same way. They moved on to Palo Alto, where Mike tried to swallow the Hoover Library. But scanners could not spin that fast, nor could Mike turn pages fast enough to read them all. At last, he admitted that he was taking in data faster than he could grok it, even spending all hours the library was closed in contemplation. With relief, Jill moved them to San Francisco, and he embarked on systematic research. She came back to their flat one day to find him doing nothing,
surrounded by books, many books, the Talmud, the Kama Sutra, Bibles in several versions, the Book of the Dead, the Book of Mormon, Patty's precious copy of the New Revelation, various Apocrypha, the Koran, the unabridged Golden Bough, the Way, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, sacred writings of a dozen other religions, major and minor, even such oddities as Crowley's Book of the Law. Trouble, dear?
Jill, I don't grok.
Waiting, Michael. Waiting for fullness is.
I don't think waiting will fill it. I know what's wrong. I'm not a man. I'm a Martian. A Martian in a body of the wrong shape.
You're plenty of man for me, dear. And I love the way your body is shaped.
Oh, you grok what I'm talking about. I don't grok people. I don't understand this multiplicity of religions. Now, among my people,
your people, Mike?
Sorry, I should have said that among Martians there is only one religion, and it is not a faith, it's a certainty. You grok it, thou art God.
Yes, she agreed. I do grok, in Martian. But dearest, it doesn't say the same thing in English. I don't know why.
On Mars, when we needed to know anything, we asked the old ones, and the answer was never wrong. Jill, is it possible that we humans don't have old ones? No souls, I mean. When we discorporate, die. We do die, dead. Die all over and nothing left. Do we live in ignorance because it doesn't matter? Because we are gone and not a rack behind in time so short that a Martian would use it for one long contemplation? Tell me, Jill, you're human.
She smiled with sober serenity. You yourself have told me. You have taught me to know eternity, and you can't take it away from me. You can't die, Mike. You can only discorporate. She gestured at herself with both hands. This body that you have taught me to see through your eyes, and that you have loved so well, someday it will be gone. But I shall not be gone. I am that I am. Thou art God, and I am God, and we are God eternally. I am not sure where I will be, or whether I will remember that I was once Jill Boardman, who was happy trotting bedpans, and equally happy strutting her stuff in the buff under bright lights. I have liked this body. With a most uncustomary gesture of impatience, Mike threw away her clothes. Thank you, dear, she said. It has been a nice body to me, and to you, to both of us who thought of it. But I don't expect to miss it when I'm through with it. I hope that you will eat it when I discorporate.
Oh, I'll eat you, all right. Unless I discorporate first.
I don't suppose you will. With your much greater control over your sweet body, I suspect that you can live several centuries at least, unless you choose to discorporate sooner.
I might, but not now. Jill, I've tried and tried. How many churches have we attended?
All the sorts in San Francisco, I think. I don't recall how many times we have been to Seeker's services.
That's just a comfort, Pat. I'd never go again if you weren't sure that she needs to know that we haven't given up.
She does need to. We can't lie. You don't know how, and I can't. Not to Patty.
Actually, he admitted, the Fosterites have quite a lot. All twisted, of course. They are groping, the way I did as a carny. They'll never correct their mistakes, because this...
He caused Patty's book to lift.
It's mostly crap.
Yes, but Patty doesn't see those parts. She is wrapped in innocence. She is God, and behaves accordingly. Only she doesn't know she is.
Uh-huh, he agreed. That's our Pat. She believes it only when I tell her, with proper emphasis. But Jill, there are only three places to look. Science... And I was taught more about how the universe ticks while I was still in the nest than human scientists can yet handle. So much that I can't talk to them, even about as elementary a gimmick as levitation. I'm not disparaging scientists. What they do is as it should be. I grok that fully. But what they are after is not what I am looking for. You don't grok a desert by counting its grains of sand. Then there's philosophy, supposed to tackle everything, does it? All any philosopher ever comes out with is what he walked in with, except for self-deluders who prove their assumptions by their conclusions, like Kant, like other tail-chasers. So the answer ought to be, here.
He waved at piles of books.
Only it's not. Bits that grok true, but never a pattern. Or if there is, they ask you to take the hard part on faith. Faith! What a dirty monosyllable. Jill, why didn't you mention that one when you were teaching me the short words that mustn't be used in polite company? She smiled. Mike, you made a joke. I didn't mean it as a joke. And I can't see that it's funny. Jill, I haven't even been good for you. You used to laugh. I haven't learned to laugh. Instead, you've forgotten. Instead of my becoming human, you're becoming Martian. I'm happy, dear. You probably just haven't noticed me laughing. If you laughed clear down on Market Street, I would hear. I grok. Once I quit being frightened by it, I always noticed it. You especially. If I grokked it, I would grok people, I think. Then I could help somebody like Pat, teach her what I know and learn what she knows. We could understand each other. Mike, all you need to do for Patty is to see her occasionally. Why don't we, dear? Let's get out of this dreary fog. She's home now. The carny is closed for the season. Drop south and see her. And I've always wanted to see Baja California. We could go on south into warmer weather. And take her with us. That would be fun. All right. She stood up. Let me get a dress. Do you want to save those books? I could ship them to Jubal. He flipped his fingers and all were gone, but Patricia's gift. We'll take that one. Pat would notice. But Jill, right now, I need to go to the zoo. All right. I want to spit back at a camel and ask him what he's sour about. Maybe camels are the old ones on this planet. And that's what's wrong with the place. Two jokes in one day, Mike. I ain't laughing. Neither are you, nor the camel. Maybe he groks why. Is this dress all right? Do you want underclothes? Please, dear. It's chilly. Up easy. He levitated her a couple of feet. Pants, stockings, garter belt, shoes. Down you go and lift your arms. Bra? You don't need one. Now the dress and you're decent. And pretty, whatever that is. You look good. Maybe I can get a job as lady's maid if I'm not good for anything else. Baths, shampoos, massages, hairstyling, makeup, dressing for all occasions. I've even learned to do your nails so it suits you. Will that be all, madame? You're a perfect lady's maid, dear. Yes, I grok I am. You look so good, I think I'll toss it away and give you a massage. The growing closer kind. Yes, Michael. I thought you had learned waiting. First, you have to take me to the zoo and buy me peanuts. Yes, Mike. It was windy cold at Golden Gate Park, but Mike did not notice, and Jill had learned how not to be cold. But it was pleasant to relax control in the warm monkey house. Aside from its heat, Jill did not like the monkey house. Monkeys and apes were depressingly human. She was, she thought, finished forever with prissiness. She had grown to cherish an ascetic, almost Martian joy in all things physical. The public copulations and evacuations of these simians did not offend her. These poor penned people possessed no privacy. They were not at fault. She could watch without repugnance, her own fastidiousness untouched. No, it was that they were human, all too human. Every action, every expression, every puzzled, troubled look reminded her of what she liked least about her own race. Jill preferred the lion house, the great males arrogant even in captivity, the placid motherliness of the big females, the lordly beauty of Bengal tigers with jungle staring out of their eyes, little leopards swift and deadly, reek of musk that air conditioning could not purge. Mike shared her tastes. They would spend hours there, or in the aviary or the reptile house, or in watching seals. Once he told her that if one had to be hatched on this planet, to be a sea lion would be of greatest goodness. When he first saw a zoo, Mike was much upset. Jill was forced to order him to wait and grok, as he had been about to free the animals. He conceded presently that most of them could not live where he proposed to turn them loose. A zoo was a nest of a sort. He followed this with hours of withdrawal, after which he never again threatened to remove bars and glass and grills. He explained to Jill that bars were to keep people out more than to keep animals in, which he had failed to grok at first. After that, Mike never missed a zoo wherever they went. But today even the misanthropy of camels could not shake Mike's moodiness, nor did monkeys and apes cheer him up. They stood in front of a cage containing a family of capuchins,
watching them eat, sleep, court, nurse, groom, and swarm aimlessly around, while Jill tossed them peanuts. She tossed one to a monk. Before he could eat it, a larger male not only stole his peanut, but gave him a beating. The little fellow made no attempt to pursue his tormentor. He pounded his knucks against the floor and chattered helpless rage. Mike watched solemnly. Suddenly, the mistreated monkey rushed across the cage, picked a monkey still smaller, bowled it over, and gave it a drubbing worse than the one he had suffered. The third monk crawled away, whimpering. The other monkeys paid no attention. Mike threw back his head and laughed, and went on laughing uncontrollably. He gasped for breath, started to tremble and sink to the floor, still laughing. "Stop it, Mike!" He did cease folding up, but his guffaws went on. An attendant hurried over. "Lady, do you need help?" "Can you call us a cab, ground air, anything? I've got to get him out of here," she added. "He's not well."
"Ambulance? Looks like he's having a fit."
"Anything."
A few minutes later, she led Mike into a piloted air cab. She gave their address, then said urgently,
"Mike, listen to me. Quiet down."
He became somewhat quiet, but continued to chuckle, laugh aloud, chuckle again, while she wiped his eyes, all the minutes it took to get home. She got him inside, got his clothes off, made him lie down.
"All right, dear. Withdraw if you need to."
"I'm all right. At last, I'm all right."
"I hope so." She sighed. "You scared me, Mike."
"I'm sorry, little brother. I was scared, too, the first time I heard laughing."
"Mike, what happened?"
"Jill, I grok people."
"Huh?"
"Hmm?" "I speak rightly, little brother. I grok. I grok people now, Jill. Little brother, precious, darling, little imp with lively legs and lovely, lewd, lascivious, lecherous, licentious libido, beautiful bumps and pert posterior, soft voice and gentle hands, my baby darling."
"Why, Michael?"
"Oh, I knew the words. I simply didn't know when or why. Say them. Nor why you wanted me to. I love you, sweetheart. I grok love now, too."
"You always have. And I love you, you smooth ape, my darling."
"Ape, yes. Come here, she-ape. Put your head on my shoulder and tell me a joke."
"Just tell you a joke?"
"Well, nothing more than snuggling. Tell me a joke I've never heard, and see if I laugh at the right place. I will, I'm sure of it. And I'll tell you why it's funny. Jill, I grok people."
"But how, darling? Can you tell me? Does it need Martian? Or mind talk?"
"No, that's the point. I grok people. I am people. So now I can say it in people talk. I've found out why people laugh. They laugh because it hurts. Because it's the only thing that'll make it stop hurting."
Jill looked puzzled. "Maybe I'm the one who isn't people. I don't understand."
"Ah, but you are people, little she-ape. You grok it so automatically that you don't have to think about it, because you grew up with people. But I didn't. I've been like a puppy raised apart from dogs who couldn't be like his masters and had never learned how to be a dog, so I had to be taught. Brother Mahmood taught me, Jubal taught me, lots of people taught me. And you taught me most of all. Today I got my diploma. And I laughed. That poor little monk."
"Which one, dear? I thought that big one was just mean. And the one I flipped the peanut to turned out to be just as mean. There certainly wasn't anything funny."
"Jill, Jill, my darling, too much Martian has rubbed off on you. Of course it wasn't funny, it was tragic. That's why I had to laugh. I looked at a cage full of monkeys, and suddenly I saw all the mean and cruel and utterly unexplainable things I've seen and heard and read about in the time I've been with my own people. And suddenly it hurt so much, I found myself laughing."
"But, Mike, dear, laughing is what you do when something is nice, not when it's horrid."
"Is it? Think back to Las Vegas, when you girls came out on stage. Did people laugh?"
"Well, no."
"But you girls were the nicest part of the show. I grok now that if they had laughed, you would have been hurt. No, they laughed when a comic tripped over his feet and fell down, or something else that is not a goodness."
"But that's not all people laugh at,
isn't it?"
Perhaps I don't grok its fullness yet. But find me something that makes you laugh, sweetheart, a joke, anything, but something that gave you a belly laugh, not a smile. Then we'll see if there isn't a wrongness somewhere, and whether you would laugh if the wrongness wasn't there. He thought, I grok when apes learn to laugh. They'll be people. Maybe. Doubtfully but earnestly, Jill started digging into her memory for jokes that had struck her as irresistibly funny, ones which had jerked a laugh out of her. Her entire bridge club. Should I bow? Neither one, you idiot. Instead. The Chinaman objects. Broke her leg. Make trouble for me. But it'll spoil the ride for me. And his mother-in-law fainted. Stop you? I bet 3-1 you could do it. Something has happened to Ole. And so are you, you clumsy ox. She gave up on funny stories, pointing out that such were just fantasies, and tried to recall real incidents. Practical jokes. All practical jokes supported Mike's thesis, even ones as mild as a dribble glass. And when it came to an intern's notion of a joke, interns should be kept in cages. What else? The time Elsa May lost her panties? It hadn't been funny to Elsa May. Or the... She said grimly, apparently the pratfall is the peak of all humor. It's not a pretty picture of the human race, Mike. Oh, but it is. Huh? I had thought, I had been told, that a funny thing is a thing of goodness. It isn't. Not ever is it funny to the person it happens to, like that sheriff without his pants. The goodness is in the laughing. I grok it as a bravery and a sharing against pain and sorrow and defeat.
But, Mike, it is not a goodness to laugh at people.
No, but I was not laughing at the little monkey. I was laughing at us, people. And suddenly I knew I was people and could not stop laughing.
He paused.
This is hard to explain because you have never lived as a Martian, for all that I've told you about it. On Mars, there is never anything to laugh at. All the things that are funny to us humans either cannot happen on Mars or are not permitted to happen. Sweetheart, what you call freedom doesn't exist on Mars. Everything is planned by the old ones. Or the things that do happen on Mars, which we laugh at here on Earth, aren't funny because there is no wrongness about them. Death, for example. Death isn't funny. Then why are there so many jokes about death? Jill, with us humans, death is so sad that we must laugh at it. All those religions, they contradict each other on every other point, but each one is filled with ways to help people be brave enough to laugh, even though they knew they are dying. He stopped, and Jill could feel that he had almost gone into a trance. Jill, is it possible that I was searching them the wrong way? Could it be that every one of all religions is true?
Huh? How could that be? Mike, if one is true, then the others are wrong.
So, point to the shortest direction around the universe. It doesn't matter where you point. It's the shortest. And you're pointing back at yourself.
Well, what does that prove?
You taught me the true answer, Mike. Thou art God. And thou art God, my lovely. But that prime fact, which doesn't depend on faith, may mean that all faiths are true.
Well, if they're all true, then right now I want to worship Shiva.
Jill changed the subject with emphatic action. Little pagan, he said softly. They'll run you out of San Francisco.
But we're going to Los Angeles, where it won't be noticed. Oh, thou art Shiva.
Dance, Kali, dance. During the night she woke and saw him standing at the window, looking out over the city.
Trouble, my brother?
He turned. There's no need for them to be so unhappy.
Darling, darling, I had better take you home. The city is not good for you.
But I would still know it. Pain and sickness and hunger and fighting. There's no need for any of it. It's as foolish as those little monkeys.
Yes, darling, but it's not your fault.
Ah, but it is.
Well, that way, yes. But it's not just this one city. It's 5 billion people and more.
You can't help 5 billion people.
I wonder.
He came over and sat by her.
I grok them now. I can talk to them, Jill. I could set up our act and make the Marks laugh every minute, I'm certain.
Then why not do it? Patty would be pleased, and so would I. I liked being with it. And now that we've shared water with Patty, it would be like being home. He didn't answer.
Jill felt his mind and knew that he was contemplating, trying to grok.
She waited.
Jill, what do I have to do to be ordained?
Part 4. His Scandalous Career. Chapter 30. The first mixed load of colonists reached Mars. 6 of 17 survivors of 23 originals returned to Earth. Prospective colonists trained in Peru at 16,000 feet. The president of Argentina moved one night to Montevideo, taking 2 suitcases. The new presidente started an extradition process before the High Court to yank him back, or at least the suitcases. Last rites for Alice Douglas were held privately in the National Cathedral, with 2,000 attending. Commentators praised the fortitude with which the Secretary General took his bereavement. A 3-year-old named Inflation, carrying 126 pounds, won the Kentucky Derby, paying 54 for one. 2 guests of the Colony Aerotel, Louisville, discorporated, one voluntarily, one by heart failure. A bootleg edition of the unauthorized biography, The Devil and Reverend Foster, appeared throughout the United States, and by nightfall every copy was burned and plates destroyed, along with damage to chattels and real estate, plus mayhem, maiming, and simple assault. The British Museum was rumored to possess a copy of the first edition, untrue, and also the Vatican Library, true, but available only to church scholars. In the Tennessee legislature, a bill was introduced to make pi equal to 3. It was reported out by the Committee on Public Education and Morals, passed without objection by the lower house, and died in the upper house. An interchurch fundamentalist group opened offices in Van Buren, Arkansas, to solicit funds to send missionaries to the Martians. Dr. Jubal Harshaw made a donation, but sent it in the name, and with the address, of the editor of The New Humanist, rabid atheist, and his close friend. Otherwise, Jubal had little to cheer him. Too much news about Mike. He treasured the visits home of Jill and Mike, and was most interested in Mike's progress, especially after Mike developed a sense of humor. But they seldom came home now, and Jubal did not relish the latest developments. It had not troubled Jubal when Mike was run out of Union Theological Seminary, pursued by a pack of enraged theologians, some of whom were angry because they believed in God, and others because they did not, but unanimous in detesting the man from Mars. Jubal reckoned anything that happened to a theologian, short of breaking him on the wheel, as no more than meat, and the experience was good for the boy. He'd know better next time. Nor had he been troubled when Mike, with the help of Douglas, enlisted under an assumed name in the Federation Armed Forces. He had been sure that no sergeant could cause Mike permanent distress, and Jubal was not troubled by what might happen to Federation troops. An unreconciled old reactionary, Jubal had burned his honorable discharge and all that went with it the day the United States ceased having its own forces. Jubal was surprised at how little shambles Mike created as Private Jones, and how long he lasted, almost 3 weeks. Mike crowned his military career by grabbing the question period following a lecture to preach the uselessness of force, with comments on the desirability of reducing surplus population through cannibalism, then offered himself as a test animal for any weapon of any nature to prove that force was not only unnecessary, but impossible when attempted against a self-disciplined person. They did not take his offer. They kicked him out. Douglas allowed Jubal to see a super-secret, eyes-only, numbered 1 of 3 report after cautioning Jubal that no one, not even the Supreme Chief of Staff, knew that Private Jones was the man from Mars. Jubal scanned the exhibits, mostly conflicting reports as to what happened when Jones had been trained in the uses of weapons. The surprising thing to Jubal was that some witnesses had the courage to state under oath that they had seen weapons disappear. The last paragraph Jubal read carefully. Conclusion. Subject man is a natural hypnotist and could conceivably be useful in intelligence, but he is unfitted for any combat branch. However, his low intelligence quotient, moron,
his extremely low general classification score, and his paranoid tendencies, delusions of grandeur, make it inadvisable to exploit his idiot savant talent. Recommendation: discharge, inaptitude. No pension credit, no benefits. Mike had managed to have fun. At parade on his last day, while Mike's platoon was passing in review, the commanding general and his staff were buried hip-deep in a bucolic end product, symbolic to all soldiers, but no longer common on parade grounds. This deposit vanished, leaving nothing but an odor and a belief in mass hypnosis. Jubal decided that Mike had atrocious taste in practical jokes. Then he recalled an incident in medical school involving a cadaver and the dean. Jubal had worn rubber gloves, and a good thing, too. Jubal enjoyed Mike's inglorious military career because Jill spent the time at home. When Mike came home after it was over, he hadn't seemed hurt by it. He boasted to Jubal that he had obeyed Jill's wishes and hadn't disappeared anybody, merely a few dead things. Although, as Mike grokked it, there had been times when Earth could have been made a better place if Jill didn't have this weakness. Jubal didn't argue. He had a lengthy better dead list himself. Mike's unique ways of growing up were all right. Mike was unique. But this last thing, the Reverend Dr. Valentine M. Smith, ABDD, PhD, founder and pastor of the Church of All Worlds, Incorporated. Gad, it was bad enough that the boy decided to be a holy Joe instead of leaving other people's souls alone, as a gentleman should. But these diploma mill degrees, Jubal wanted to throw up. The worst was that Mike claimed that he had hatched the idea from something Jubal had said about what a church was and what it could do. Jubal admitted that it was something he could have said, although he did not recall it. Mike had been cagey about the operation. Some months of residence at a very small, very poor sectarian college, a bachelor's degree awarded by examination, a call to their ministry, followed by ordination in this recognized, though flat-headed sect, a doctor's dissertation on comparative religion, which was a marvel of scholarship while ducking any conclusions, the award of the earned doctorate coinciding with an endowment, anonymous to this very hungry school, the second doctorate, honorary, for contributions to interplanetary knowledge from a university that should have known better, when Mike let it be known that such was his price for appearing at a conference on solar system studies. The man from Mars had turned down everybody from Caltech to Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in the past. Harvard could not resist the bait. Well, they were as crimson as their banner now, Jubal thought cynically. Mike put in a few weeks as assistant chaplain at his church mouse alma mater, then broke with the sect in a schism and founded his own church. Completely kosher, legally airtight, as venerable in precedent as Martin Luther, and as nauseating as last week's garbage. Jubal was called out of his sour daydream by Miriam.
Boss, company.
Jubal looked up to see a car about to land.
Larry, fetch my shotgun. I swore I would shoot the next dolt who landed on the rose bushes.
He's landing on the grass, boss.
Tell him to try again. We'll get him on the next pass.
Looks like Ben Caxton.
So it is. Hi, Ben. What'll you drink?
Nothing, you professional bad influence. Need to talk to you, Jubal.
You're doing it. Dorcas, fetch Ben a glass of warm milk. He's sick.
Without much soda, amended Ben, and milk the bottle with the three dimples. Private talk, Jubal.
All right, up to my study. Although, if you can keep anything from the kids around here, let me in on your method.
After Ben finished greeting properly, and unsanitarily in three cases, members of the family, they moseyed upstairs. Ben said,
What the deuce? Am I lost?
Oh, you haven't seen the new wing. Two bedrooms and another bath downstairs. And up here, my gallery.
Enough statues to fill a graveyard.
Please, Ben, statues are dead politicians. This is sculpture. Please speak in a reverent tone, lest I become violent.
Here are replicas of some of the greatest sculpture this naughty globe has produced.
Well, that hideous thing I've seen before. But when did you acquire the rest of this ballast?
Jubal spoke to the replica of La Belle Aulmière.
Do not listen, ma petite chère. He is a barbarian and knows no better.
He put his hand to her beautiful, ravaged cheek, then gently touched one empty, shrunken dug.
I know how you feel, It can't be much longer. Patience, my lovely.
He turned to Caxton and said briskly, Ben, you will have to wait while I give you a lesson in how to look at sculpture. You've been rude to a lady. I don't tolerate that.
Huh? Don't be silly, Jubal. You're rude to ladies. Live ones, a dozen times a day.
Jubal shouted, Anne, upstairs. Wear your cloak.
You know I wouldn't be rude to the old woman who posed for that. What I can't understand is a so-called artist having the gall to pose somebody's great-grandmother in her skin, and you having the bad taste to want it around.
Anne came in, cloaked.
Jubal said, Anne, have I ever been rude to you, or to any of the girls?
That calls for opinion.
That's what I'm asking for. You're not in court.
You have never been rude to any of us, Jubal.
Have you ever known me to be rude to a lady?
I have seen you be intentionally rude to a woman. I've never seen you be rude to a lady.
One more opinion. What do you think of this bronze?
Anne looked at Rodin's masterpiece, said slowly, When I first saw it, I thought it was horrible. But I've come to the conclusion that it may be the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Thanks, that's all.
She left.
Want to argue, Ben?
Huh? When I argue with Anne, that day I turn in my suit. But I don't grok it.
Attend me, Ben. Anybody can see a pretty girl. An artist can look at a pretty girl and see the old woman she will become. A better artist can look at an old woman and see the pretty girl she used to be. A great artist can look at an old woman, portray her exactly as she is, and force the viewer to see the pretty girl she used to be. More than that, he can make anyone with the sensitivity of an armadillo see that this lovely young girl is still alive, prisoned inside her ruined body. He can make you feel the quiet, endless tragedy that there was never a girl born who ever grew older than 18 in a heart, no matter what the merciless hours have done. Look at it, Ben. Growing old doesn't matter to you and me, but it does to them. Look at it.
Ben looked at her. Presently, Jubal said gruffly,
All right, blow your nose. Come, sit down.
No, Caxton answered. How about this one? I see it's a girl, but why tie her up like a pretzel?
Jubal looked at the replica, caryatid who has fallen under her stone. I won't expect you to appreciate the masses, which make that figure much more than a pretzel. But you can appreciate what Rodin was saying. What do people get out of looking at a crucifix?
You know I don't go to church. Still, you must know that representations of the crucifixion are usually atrocious, and ones in churches are the worst. Blood like ketchup, and that ex-carpenter portrayed as if he were a pansy, which he certainly was not. He was a hearty man, muscular and healthy. But a poor portrayal is as effective as a good one for most people. They don't see defects. They see a symbol which inspires their deepest emotions. It recalls to them the agony and sacrifice of God.
Jubal, I thought you weren't a Christian. Does that make me blind to human emotion?
The crummiest plaster crucifix can evoke emotions in the human heart so strong that many have died for them. The artistry with which such a symbol is wrought is irrelevant. Here we have another emotional symbol, but wrought with exquisite artistry.
Ben, for 3,000 years, architects designed buildings with columns shaped as female figures. At last, Rodin pointed out that this was work too heavy for a girl. He didn't say, Look, you jerks, if you must do this, make it a brawny male figure. No, he showed it. This poor little caryatid has fallen under the load. She's a good girl. Look at her face. Serious, unhappy at a failure, not blaming anyone, not even the gods, and still trying to shoulder her load after she's crumpled under it.
But she's more than good art denouncing bad art. She's a symbol for every woman who ever shouldered a load too heavy. But not alone women. This symbol means every man and woman who ever sweated out life in uncomplaining fortitude until they crumpled under their loads. It's courage, Ben, and victory.
Victory?
Victory and defeat. There is none higher. She didn't give up, Ben. She's still trying to lift that stone after it has crushed her. She's a father working while cancer eats away his insides to bring home one more paycheck. She's a 12-year-old trying to mother her brothers and sisters because Mama had to go to heaven. She's a switchboard operator sticking to a post while smoke chokes her and fire cuts off her escape. She's all the unsung heroes who couldn't make it but never quit.
Come, salute as you pass, and come see my little mermaid.
Ben took him literally. Jubal made no comment.
Now this, he said, is one Mike didn't give to me. I haven't told Mike why I got it, since it is self-evident that it's one of the most delightful compositions ever wrought by the eye and hand of man. This one I don't need explained. It's pretty, which is excuse enough, as with kittens and butterflies. But there is more. She's not quite a mermaid, see? Nor is she human. She sits on land, where she has chosen to stay, and stares eternally out to sea, forever lonely for what she left. You know the story?
Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes. She sits by the haven of Kubenhavn, and she's everybody who ever made a difficult choice. She doesn't regret it, but she must pay for it. Every choice must be paid for. The cost is not only endless homesickness. She can never be quite human. When she uses her dearly bought feet, every step is on sharp knives. Ben, I think that Mike walks always on knives. But don't tell him I said so. I won't. I'd rather look at her and not think about knives. She's a little darling, isn't she? How would you like to coax her into bed? She'd be as lively as a seal and as slippery. Cripes, you're an evil old man, Jubal. And getting eviler every year. We won't look at any others. I usually ration myself to one a day. Suits. I feel as if I had had three quick drinks.
Jubal, why isn't there stuff like this where a person can see it?
Because the world has gone nutty, and art always paints the spirit of its times. Rodin died about the time the world started flipping its lid. His successors noted the amazing things he had done with light and shadow and mass and composition, and they copied that part. What they failed to see was that the master told stories that laid bare the human heart. They became contemptuous of painting or sculpture that told stories. They dubbed such work literary. They went all out for abstractions.
Jubal shrugged.
Abstract design is all right. For wallpaper or linoleum, but art is the process of evoking pity and terror. What modern artists do is pseudo-intellectual masturbation. Creative art is intercourse, in which the artist renders emotional his audience. These laddies who won't deign to do that, or can't, lost the public. The ordinary bloke will not buy art that leaves him unmoved. If he does, the money is conned out of him by taxes or such.
Jubal, I've always wondered why I didn't give a hoot for art. I thought it was something missing in me.